Minister and the delegation from IPIT to our meeting. And we will want to appreciate the fact that we received their documents well on time, and such members had enough time to read them. As a matter of fact, they were distributed to members during our last meeting, which we said should be a norm, and we are appreciating that. We have two items on our agenda. The first item is on CIRA regulation, but the second one will be adopting minutes that are before the portfolio committee. I think it is important maybe for now to comment on what probably is not related to IPIT, but what we are seeing in the department that we are responsible for its oversight, and that is the Department of Police. I think we have seen what one can easily describe as chaos and outright fiasco that is taking place within the Department of Police, which I think it leaves a lot to be desired. We will remember that when the department appeared before the portfolio committee on the 17th of April, we allowed the department to take us through on three issues. One, the Katumano unit, dubbed that squad, the General Wisdom head of the Hawks and KZN issue, and of course, a General Mzuli's issue. We allowed members to make statements on the matters, which they said, including the chairperson, they will support the acting National Commissioner in his investigation on this matter. I want to believe that those members who said that still stand by that decision, because as far as we are concerned, that can only be a noble decision. Since then, we got to know that the department intended to suspend General Wisdom, and he took the matter to the Labour Court, and that suspension was reversed. We've since seen that again with General Mzuli, first not knowing whether his suspension was received. A letter of intention to suspend him was received by him. Later received decision being reversed, decision effected. Issues that are coming up out of these matters are seriously worrying. Seated here, we're not very sure whether we have a united management at the level of national management. Some of us who visit police stations have hope that at least police stations are still doing their work, but we're not very sure whether they are receiving what the Constitution refers to as manage and control police. All that we think is happening is people that are thinking about who am I going to fight and how am I going to fight, who am I going to win, how am I going to win, and I think that is chaos. We've since decided that we cannot, as the portfolio committee, sit and watch. Probably we need a full briefing on what actually is happening and what happened and what is going to happen going forward. We believe that these matters are at the level of operation because, as a matter of fact, our worry is how police is managed and how it is controlled. How effective is that? We therefore have decided that we will call an urgent meeting next week, wherein the acting national commissioner is going to take us through as to what is actually happening. We've been made to understand that there might, even if these are not confirmed, but that there might be suspensions coming and so on and so forth. Some senior managers resigning and citing reasons for resignations that are only worrying. We think that is chaos. And therefore, we are going to have a meeting next week. The reason why I cannot specify the day is because on Tuesday we have a short meeting. I understand the sitting will start at 11. To the extent that we have requested to move our meeting to Wednesday. Our normal meeting with the Secretariat on DNA policy. But we believe that probably on that day as well, we might invite the department to come and brief us on this matter. We will request that members prepare for that meeting in every way so that we know exactly when the department leaves here, whether we have a management or we don't have, or whether we have a department or we don't have, or whether we have police in this country or we don't have. The Constitution demands of police that are apolitical. When there are issues that are suggesting in any way that we might actually be having police that are pushing a political agenda, that is frightening, to say the least. We therefore will want to get clarity as to whether there are any truths in all this matter. We will indeed inform members. Our take for now is that possibly on Wednesday next week, we might have two items on our agenda, the briefing on the policy on DNA, and of course the briefing by the department on these matters that we have raised. I just want to say it once more that this whole thing is worrying, and we cannot afford to have a department that is on the news for all the wrong reasons every day. And it cannot be the police, because that actually talks to the security of the country. And police are to actually provide that first line security of the country. If the police are shaken as they are right now, as I think they are, all that happens that all of us worry. And it is in that spirit that as a portfolio committee, we think that we need to have a special meeting on this matter and deal with it once and for all and know exactly as to what is going to happen. We will move on to the matter. We will move on to the matter that is before the that is before us.
Chairman, I'm not trying to be difficult or trying to, but in the light of what you are saying, and in the light of what is happening in the police, which is what you are saying is true, I would have thought that the minister who accounts to Parliament, even if he comes with his management, must come and account to Parliament as to what is happening in the police. Not just because, we, like you are saying, we don't know who is involved. I don't even know, as I'm sitting here, whether even that acting national commissioner is involved. As at least if we're to get some assurance from the minister that at least there's still policing happening in our country, to me it would make sense. That's why, in my view, I would advise, of course, if the minister, that if the minister himself could come and address us on this issue which you have raised, I would be very happy.
Thank you very much. We'll consider that. We still believe that some of these matters are at operational level, but we'll consider what Honorable Judge is saying. The matter before the Portfolio Committee is on the regulations regarding IT. And as I have indicated, and I think as members are aware, we passed that bill. It is now an act, and indeed it is with effect on the 1st of April this year. And as such, according to that, we are to scrutinize as Parliament the regulations that they have developed. We will then allow the Executive Director to take us through, but probably to appreciate on my side the manner in which they attended to the matter that I brought to the attention of the Executive Director regarding a boy who was shot at by a member of the police in a bar with service pistols and off-duty member. And when I got to know about the matter, it was that nothing had happened until I had intervened. And I understand that today he's appearing before court for bail application, and I'm told that there are people picketing outside who are opposing his bail. I actually listened to your interview on the SAFM yesterday and your media statement. One thing that this act says is that if anyone who is not informing you about this matter is guilty of an offense, and one will expect IPED not to hesitate to take those steps, because it is only when from the beginning you implement the act as is that people will know that they can't hide these things. It cannot be that there is only steps or actions taken because somebody from somewhere has phoned, and only then that you get to know about it. I think people who pretend to, or who want to hide these things as they've been doing in the past, this time around you have got an act that is there for it to be implemented. It's an act anyway, and it is direct, it's clear what it says. You can't think outside it. Whatever it has got to be within the act, whatever else it is got to be within the act. It has been there for quite a long time. Police are supposed to have had their own workshops, briefings, and so on. They cannot be an excuse, because for me, ignorance about the law is no excuse, and therefore it should not be an excuse for police members as such. So I just want to say that when people do not implement this act, I think IPED must deal with those people, the culprit or the suspect, but the station commander responsible for that must also be held accountable so that it doesn't happen. I just want to say that. But I really want to appreciate the manner in which you attended in this matter and the feedback that you gave on the matter. And I want to believe that you are aware that that boy has since died. So it's now a murder charge. It's no longer an attempted murder, because he shot him on the head. And he was sleeping in the ICU for some days and eventually died. So it's off duty. I just want to say that. Over to you, Executive Director.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, Honourable Members. We are going to do a briefing on the IPED regulations as indicated by the Honourable Chairperson. Chairperson, maybe just to introduce the delegation. To my left is Mr. Matthew Sissoko, the Acting Head of Investigations, then Ms. Casey Mbeki, who is our Head of Legal Services, and then Mr. Gela, sorry, they changed places. Next to Mr. Sogo is Ms. Tugela, who is our acting head in the of the province in the Western Cape, and she was also part of the task team that assisted with the regulations. Chairperson, in terms of the presentation, I'm going to focus on the principles that was used in the drafting of the regulations. Mr. Tugela is going to focus on the process that we followed, and then Mr. Sisoko and Ms. Mbeki will speak to the regulations in brief. Maybe, Chairperson, just to indicate again, I think the regulations should not be read in isolation. On the one hand, we've got the IPED Act, we've got the regulations, but then very importantly also the standing operating procedures of IPED as such. That's really the rule book for our investigators on the ground. So those three documents is really the basis, and of course the ED guidelines that will also be developed as we move along. Now, in terms of the principles for the drafting of regulations, quite importantly, the regulations must be authorized by the Enabling Act. Of course, in the IPED Act, that is in Section 34. The regulations may not increase the ambit, scope, or purpose of the Enabling Act. Generally, regulations cannot give officials powers or functions not provided for in the Act. Such powers and duties should rather be specified in the Act. The regulations must be intra vires the Enabling Act, and the regulations must not be vague or uncertain, and it must contain adequate information as to the duties of those who are being regulated, and it must be reasonable. That's why we've also tried to put the obligations also of the IPED investigators very practical, so that we can measure it, that we know they know exactly what they must do. Then the regulations may not contradict the Constitution, and it also meets the requirements of constitutionality. Then the regulations must follow the style of the Enabling Act and may not be in conflict with the Principal Act. They may not be used to remedy a defect in the Act or used to interpret the Act. Then furthermore, Honourable Chairperson, no provision of the Act, including the definition section, can be repeated in the regulations. And unless the Act expressly and specifically grants the power to do so, the regulation should not create offences or impose penalties. Then the need to interpret the Enabling Act to see what powers it confers or is deemed to confer by necessary implication. Regulations may provide for ancillary matters which are reasonable necessary to be dealt with in the exercise of the delegated power. Then regulations cannot confer jurisdiction or impose duties on courts of law unless given such power by an Act of Parliament. And regulations may not amount to an unreasonable exercise of the delegated power. Then in terms of slide number 6, the regulations may not widen the purpose of the Act, add new or different means of carrying it out, or depart from or vary the plan which were intended by the Act. Now, a regulation will fall within the scope of the general empowerment provision if it's required for contributing to the implementation of the Act. It's of administrative or procedural nature. It's a subsidiary means of implementing the provisions of the Act. It's incidental to carrying out the Act-specific provisions. It does not widen the purpose of the Act. It does not add new or different means to achieve the Act's purpose. An Act requiring regulation should not be put in operation before the regulations have been promulgated. In our case, the IPED Act, we couldn't operate without the regulations being in place. So that's quite important to note. Mr. Geller will now talk to the process.
Thank you, Chairperson. The process which was followed in the development of the regulations was that a workshop was held on 28 July 2010 with the provincial head, deputy provincial head, and program managers in order to review existing standard operating procedures and analyze the proposed content of the new operating procedures to be in line with the regulations and the new legislation. A follow-up workshop was held on 25 August 2010 to debate and analyze the proposed content of the regulations to the IPED Bill. The distribution of first draft of the regulations to staff members for input was made in November 2010. Three consultative workshops were thereafter held on 21 January, 28 January 2011, and on 1 March 2011 with relevant stakeholders regarding the proposed content of the regulations. The aforementioned stakeholders included the ICT staff, other government departments, and civil society organizations. The input and contributions received during the consultative workshop were taken into consideration and incorporated into the draft regulation before the publication thereof. The legal and operational implications of the draft regulations were in addition taken into consideration, and amendments were effected where necessary. Publication of the draft regulations for public comment in the Government Gazette number 34139 of 2011 was on 23 March 2011. The submission of the copy of Government Gazette with draft regulations to the Portfolio Committee on Police for information purposes was on 24 March 2011. Publication of draft regulations on ICD website for public comment and the communication was sent to staff on 25 March 2011. Submission of draft regulations for scrutiny to the state law advisors was made on June 2011. Approval of draft regulations by the Minister of Police was on 6 December 2011. And the submission of draft regulations to the Portfolio Committee on Police was made on 8 December 2011. The publication was approved and published in the Government Gazette on 10 February 2012. The publication of IP regulation on department's website was made on March 2012. The date of implementation of the regulations was simultaneously with the IP Act, which was 1 April 2012. The review and amendment of standard operating procedures was done from September 2011 to March 2012. And the executive director approved the final standard operating procedures on 30 March 2012. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chairperson and honourable members. I will now give start with the presentation of the substance of the regulation. I will start with regulation 2. I'll just skip regulation 1 because it only deals with definitions and interpretation. Regulation 1 deals with reporting of matters that need to be investigated. In an attempt to simplify these regulations, I will first deal with the basis of this regulation, linking it to the IPED Act, and also focusing on who should report, what should be reported, and when should those matters be reported, how they should be reported, as well as to whom those matters should be reported. With regard to the link of this particular regulation to the Act, the basis of this regulation is Section 29 of the IPED Act, which provides for reporting obligations and cooperation by members of the South African Police Service, as well as members of the Municipal Police Service. And the persons that have been identified in terms of the Act as well as the regulations as the persons who have an obligation to report certain matters to IPED are the station commander or any member of the South African Police Service or any member of the Municipal Police Service. What needs to be reported by the associate members are all the cases that are listed in Section 28, Subsection 1, Subsection A up to F. And these being deaths in police custody, deaths as a result of police action, any complaint relating to the discharge of an official firearm by any police officer, rape by a police officer, whether the police officer is on or off duty, rape of any person in police custody, as well as any complaint of torture or assault against a police officer in the execution of his or her duties. With regard to when these matters have to be reported, the regulation provides that these matters have to be reported immediately or as soon as the said member becomes aware of the particular case. And that can be done telephonically. But then within 24 hours, there has to be a written report in terms of Form 1 that is provided or submitted to any IP provincial office or the national office. This regulation does not preclude any member of the public to lodge a complaint with IP. The only difference is that with members of the public, they are not necessarily obliged in terms of the Act, although we know that they have to report these matters. And it is also not a requirement that members of the public report these matters to IPED via SAPS or NPS. They can report directly to IPED. And members of the public can report these matters, the matters that have been mentioned above, as well as corruption. And what needs to be noted is that the reporting of corruption matters or cases is not necessarily an obligation on the members of SAPS in terms of the Act as it stands currently. And members of the public are expected to report using Form 2, which is attached to the regulation. And members of the public can report in person by walking into one of our offices, or by fax or email or telephonically, and they can be assisted by IPED members to fill in the Form 2 that needs to be filled in. And it is also not a requirement that we have to have all the information that is required in terms of that form for the matter to be investigated. I will then now go to Regulation 3. In this regulation, I'll focus mainly, it's a regulation that deals with receiving, registering, processing, referral and disposing of complaints. I will deal mostly with who may receive complaints and what has to be done once a complaint has been received by us. And I will also then link this particular regulation to the standard operating procedures, because it's the standard operating procedures that provide for a much more detailed step-by-step on what needs to be done from the beginning of the process. And with regard to who may receive a complaint, the regulation provides that it's any member of IPED or any designated member at a provincial level as well as at national level. And what needs to be done by that member immediately after receiving a complaint, that member needs to determine first whether this matter falls within the ambit of the provisions of Section 28, which means that we need to determine whether the matter falls within matters that have to be investigated by IPED in terms of the IPED Act. And if the complaint falls outside the provisions of Section 28, that particular member would then need to refer the matter to an appropriate institution. But if the complaint falls within the above-mentioned provisions, the member needs to register that matter on the IPED database. But the details on how that has to be done are provided for in the standard operating procedure. And what is also expected from that member is to inform the complainant in writing about the registration of that matter and who will be investigating the case if the case falls within the matters that have to be investigated by IPED. But if the complaint falls outside our mandate, then the IPED member needs to inform the complainant about the referral of that particular matter, as to which institution the matter has been referred to, and what it is that the complainant needs to do, and how that complainant can contact that particular institution. And the standard operating procedure makes provision for a detailed process with regard to the registration as well as the processing of complaints. More specifically, the much more relevant clauses are clause 5.8 as well as clause 7.2 of the standard operating procedure. Clause 5.8 of the standard operating procedure provides for a case intake committee whose job it is to review, determine and allocate cases amongst investigators, as well as to give directives on what it is that needs to be done in respect of each case and what the reporting timelines and processes are. Clause 7.2 of the standard operating procedures provide for the procedure for the registration of cases, both manually as well as electronically. I will then now move to Regulation 4, which provides for investigation of deaths in police custody or as a result of police action. With this particular regulation, I'll focus on the how part. How does this investigation have to be conducted and when it has to be conducted? With regard to the provisions, once we are mindful of the fact that the much more detailed step-by-step is provided for in the standard operating procedure, The regulation provides that the investigator, immediately after being assigned a particular case, has to attend to the scene where the death occurred. He or she also has to record the details of the deceased, identify and record details of potential witnesses, authorize the removal of a corpse, collect exhibits and other evidentiary material, and where necessary, refer that material or any other exhibits to forensic laboratory, as well as visiting the next of kin of the deceased to inform them of the death, and visit and interview witnesses and obtain statements, and also attend postmortem. And after collecting all the evidence and statements, that particular investigator has to report to the provincial head or to the executive director, and then make a determination as to whether such a member must be arrested or not. And he has to do that in consultation with the provincial head or the executive director, who has to give direction on whether an arrest has to be effected. And once that determination and decision has been made, the investigator has to make sure that he follows the process as outlined in Section 39 of the Criminal Procedure Act, which provides a much more detailed process on how to effect an arrest with or without a warrant of arrest, when and how a warrant of arrest has to be obtained, and who can issue a warrant of arrest. And with regard to when or how long the entire investigation has to take, the investigation must be finalized within 90 days, failing which the investigator must give reasons for such failure, and also provide feedback to the complainant or a next of kin in writing at least once every month. In the case of late notification of a death in police custody or as a result of police action, the investigator must, within 30 days of designation by the provincial head or the executive director, conduct a preliminary investigation or a full investigation, depending on the circumstances and the direction provided by the provincial head and the executive director. And he must also attend postmortem, if postmortem has not yet been conducted, and interview witnesses, and then consider the desirability of reconstructing the scene of death, and then take over police docket for further investigation, and then make recommendations to the NPA for criminal charges or to SAPS for disciplinary action. And a much more detailed process is provided for in clause 7.3 of the standard operating procedure as to what exactly needs to be done and how that needs to be done. Chairperson, with your permission, I will now hand over to Mr. Sisoko to take us through the remainder of the regulation. Thanks.
Thank you, Chairperson and honorable members. I'll take you through the rest of the regulations. I'll start dealing with Regulation 5, which deals with investigation of criminal matters. This regulation deals with categories of criminal matters, which is rape of a person in police custody and rape of a person by a member of the FAPS or MPS member, whether on or off duty, torture or assault by a member of FAPS or MPS in the execution of his or her duties, corruption by a member of FAPS or NPS. How this to be done? If a police docket has been opened, take over the docket and conduct all outstanding investigations. If the docket has not been opened, open the docket for purpose of investigation, interview victim and record his or her details, identify and record particulars of witnesses, interview witnesses and take statements, collect exhibits and other evidence, if necessary, refer exhibits to forensic laboratory. In cases of rape, ensure that the victim is examined by a medical practitioner, ensure that the sexual assault kit is obtained and sealed, and sent to forensic laboratory. Observe procedures provided for in Section 28, 31, 32, 33, 34, 36, and 37 of the Criminal Law, Sexual Offense and Related Matters, Amended Act 2 of 2000, 7. This relates to where you have to help the victim in terms of HIV testing and so forth, and also ascertaining the bodily features of an accused person for the purposes of the proof in the criminal trial. In case of corruption, observe the provision of Section 34 of the Prevention of Combating Corrupt Activities. This section relates to the procedures in terms of how to obtain statements in these corruption matters. In cases of torture or assault, ensure that the victim is examined by a medical practitioner, attend and secure the scene where the alleged torture occurred, visit all identified witnesses and obtain statements. After collecting statements and exhibits, submit to the provincial head and executive director and make recommendation for disciplinary action or prosecution or both. When the investigation must be finalized within 90 days, failing which the investigator must give written reasons for such failure. Feedback to the complainant or the next of kin must be given in writing at least once every month. Clause 7.4 of the Standard Operating Procedure makes provision for the procedure to be followed when investigating criminal matters. Regulation 6 relates to the investigation of discharge of an official firearm. This relates to a complaint of a discharge of an official firearm by a member of the SAPS or MPS, whether on or off duty, or whether any injury was sustained or not as a result thereof. How this needs to be done? If a docket has been opened, take over the docket and conduct all outstanding investigation. If a docket has not been opened, open a docket and conduct investigation, interview and take statements from witnesses, collect relevant evidence and exhibits, send exhibits to forensic laboratory or ballistic testing, submit report to the provincial head or the executive director, and make recommendations for disciplinary action or criminal prosecution. These investigations are also to be finalized within 90 days, failing which the investigator must give written reasons for failure to finalize these matters within 90 days, and feedback must also be given in writing once every month. Clause 7.4 also of the Standard Operating Procedure is relevant in these matters. I'll then move to Regulation 7, which deals with investigation of referred matters. The purpose of this is to make it possible for IPID to investigate any matter referred to it as a result of a decision by the Executive Director, or if so requested by the Minister, an MEC, or the Secretary, as the case may be. Section 28(1)(h) of the IPID is relevant in this regard. This regulation also ensures full compliance with Section 206 of the Constitution. The Executive Director must designate an investigator to investigate a matter. The executive director or the provincial head will give direction with regard to the investigation and the time frame within which the investigation must be finalized and the manner of disposal. In terms of how this to be done, the investigator will make recommendations to the provincial head and the executive director and provide feedback in writing once every month. Move to Regulation 8, which provides for securing of the crime scene. This regulation provides for the procedure for securing the crime scene. For example, cordoning off of the crime scene, collecting of evidence and exhibit, handling of corpse and other evidential material, control of access to the crime scene. Clause 7.3 of the Standard Operating Procedure make provisions for procedure to be followed when securing crime scene. I'll then move to Regulation 9, which deals with identification parade, taking of affidavits, giving of evidence, production of documents, and submission of information cooperation by the police. This must be done in accordance with the relevant procedure applicable to the members of the SAPS. SAPS members and MPS are obliged to cooperate with IPID as provided for in Section 292 of the IPID Act. A member of the IPID may require written reason for failure by a member of the SAPS to cooperate with IPID and make recommendations to the Executive Director, the Provincial Head, regarding disciplinary measures to be taken against such a member. And this cooperation must be done within 48 hours of request. I move to Regulation 10, which deals with access and control of confidential materials and information and records. This deals with the securing of all information, documentation, and records pertaining to an investigation and to prevent access to such information by an authorized person. A member of the IPID who divulges information in contravention of this regulation is guilty of a misconduct and a criminal offense. I then move members to Regulation 11, which deals with integrity testing and the confidentiality of information relating to integrity testing. Who may conduct or authorize an integrity testing procedure? This can be done by the Executive Director or an authorized member of the IPID or any other person so authorized by the Executive Director. Integrity testing may involve entrapment, testing for the abuse of alcohol or drugs, or the use of polygraph tests or any similar instrument. With regard to approval, entrapment can only be performed after the approval by the Director of Public Prosecution and in accordance with the Criminal Procedure Act and the National Director of Public Prosecution instructions or guidelines. Testing for abuse of alcohol or drugs or the use of polygraph or any similar instrument can only be performed with written approval by the Executive Director. A member of the IPID must submit to integrity testing. Integrity measures must be applied with due regard to decency and the right of the member to dignity and privacy. Information obtained through this process may not be disclosed except in circumstances provided for in sub-regulation 13. Consequences of integrity testing. With regard to entrapment, if the results impact negatively on the integrity of the member, the Executive Director may require such a member to undergo counseling, rehabilitation, or retraining, require such a member to subject himself or herself to a security screening in terms of Section 2 of the National Strategic Intelligence Act, or take disciplinary or other action against such a member. With regard to testing for alcohol and drugs, if finding that a member has evidence of alcohol or drugs in breath, blood or urine, the Executive Director may suspend such a member, require such a member to undergo counseling or rehabilitation, send such a member for medical examination and report on the member's fitness to proceed with his duties, reassign duties, or take disciplinary action where appropriate. Regulation 12 deals with the disciplinary referrals. These disciplinary referrals can be done by the Executive Director or the Provincial Head, and the referral can be made to the National or Provincial Commissioner of the SAPS or even the MPS. The regulation makes provision with regard to Form 3 in terms of how these referrals must be done. Regulation 13 deals with disciplinary procedures in relation to IPID members. In cases of alleged misconduct or failure to comply with a lawful command or order or instruction, and these disciplinary measures can only be done in line with the Public Service Disciplinary Code. Regulation 14 deals with the security screening of investigators, and this must be done in accordance with Section 202A of the Strategic Intelligence Act. And then Regulation 15 deals with the reporting. This reporting is the annual report to the Minister and Parliament, and at any time when requested to do so by the Minister and Parliament. And the report will be with regard to the activities of the Directorate. These regulations, in terms of Regulation 16, may be supplemented by the Executive Director's Guidelines and the Protocol on Cooperation entered into by and between IPID, SAPS, and Metropolis Services. I must indicate here that with regard to the Protocol on Cooperation, this process is at its advanced stage. I think we had already had discussions with the SAPS and MPS. In the next forum meeting of this organization, the last draft of the protocol with all the inputs from these three departments will be tabled for ratification, whereby after that it will be sent to principal for signature. With regard to Regulation 16, also the standard operating procedure of the IPID, clause 8 thereof, provides that the standard operating procedures must be read in conjunction with the regulations and the Act, therefore reinforcing that every action, even if provided for in the SOPs, must be done in accordance with the regulations. I thank you, Chairperson.
Chairperson, that concludes the presentation.
No, thank you very much. We normally do not talk about cell phones in our meeting, so if the matter that does not arise, so it shouldn't. Chapter 9 of the Act is with regard to offences and penalties. That is Chapter 9, 331. 2345. Any police officer who fails to comply with Section 29 is guilty of an offence and liable on conviction to a fine or to imprisonment for a period not exceeding 2 years. Any member who fails to make disclosure in accordance with Section 25(2), that is conflict of interest, or fails to withdraw in terms of Section 25(2), as the case may be, is guilty of an offence and liable on conviction to a fine or to imprisonment for a period not exceeding 2 years. Any member of the Directorate who willfully discloses information in circumstances in which he or she knows or could reasonably be expected to know that such a disclosure will or may prejudicially affect the exercise or the performance by the Directorate of the powers and functions is guilty of an offence and liable on conviction to a fine or to imprisonment for a period not exceeding 2 years. I'm just saying that I'm not very sure whether you've included this in your regulation. I'm just asking because for me this equally is important, but of course let me take hence Honourable Annelies, Honourable Kola Banat, Honourable Reverend Misha, Honourable NG, Honourable Lichetto, in that order.
Thank you, Chairperson. Yeah, I've got thanks for the regulations and the time is tabling those as well. I've got a couple of questions. that you have, I think in broad terms, it, I could have dealt with the act, but I think there are shortcomings. The first one I want to raise is the fact that if you read Regulation 4B, in terms of a member of the public laying a complaint, I think it's a challenge that we expect the member of the public to lay the complaint in the same way as you would expect a member of SAPS or the NPS laying a complaint. I heard you saying that that person can also enter the IPED offices and lay a complaint and will be assisted. However, the regulation does not spell that out. And we all know the challenges that we are going to get is that you would have a satellite office or a provincial office where somebody will enter and will not get the assistance they are supposed to be getting. So I think that is a definite shortcoming when we look at ordinary members of public. I'm also worried, Chairperson, in terms of still the accessibility of IPED offices to the broader public. So what we're saying here is if you can't lay the complaint by getting assistance from either people in the satellite office or the provincial office, then you've got to fax through a complaint similar or completion of Form 2. Now, we also know that people, especially in deep rural areas, won't have access to those. So I'm really worried about the regulations around delaying of complaints by ordinary members of the public. And I do believe we need to relook at it. Even if we then talk about the fact that the ward councillor can lay the complaint on behalf of the complainant, or can assist the complainant, or can be the point. I don't have the solution, it's up to you to make the solution, but I don't believe we can treat. I think what we've done here is that we've dealt with SAPS and the NPS very well, but we haven't clearly thought through how the ordinary member of public is going to be able to lay a complaint, specifically when we look at our deep rural areas. That's the first thing. I want to know why there's no regulations for 341F, special investigations. I think if we're not going to have, I know it's difficult because we're talking about special investigations, and we don't know what the nature of special investigations are going to be. I know that you in 73C have tried to have a catch-all type of regulation, but that's not going to work. And my worry is that if we don't think about how special investigations is going to be dealt with, it will just disappear. Then we can just as well now change the act and take out special investigations. And that was not the intention of the legislature. That's the second question, Chairperson. Third question that I have is in terms of your clustering together of rape, assault, corruption in terms of your regulations, whether this is the best way to do it. I can understand that you can cluster together the rape, whether on or off duty, but surely you need a specialized type of investigator to deal with corruption type of issues. And are we really saying that assault, rape, and corruption are going to be dealt with in the same way by IPED? I mean, you're the specialist, but I've got a question mark on that issue. And then also, if you look at Regulation 4, it says that everything... two issues around 4. Regulation 4. The first is that it implies that all investigations around that must be completed within 24 hours. So what it says is that the crime scene, the forensics, etc. Now we know that's not going to happen. And it's not possible to rewrite it that we clearly state what it is that we expect in 24 hours and then what it is that we expect. For instance, when do we expect a forensic science laboratory to come back to us, etc. Same regulation. I've got a concern in my mind about the fact that the way it's written, I don't think it was your intention, but the way it's written, it indicates that your investigator will now be responsible for the registration, handling, transportation and disposal of exhibits. That's normally the forensic science laboratory's competency. Why is it that you want your investigator now to take over that responsibility? If your intention not there simply to make sure that it's done, then I think you need to rewrite that regulation, because as it's written currently, it indicates that your investigator will be responsible for it. If it's your investigator's responsibility to oversee that process taking place, that's fine. But then we need to make it clear. You're also on regulation 4, Chair, you're not clear on what happens if it's a late report of a death in custody, if the post-mortem was already conducted. Surely there must be a regulation that says you must then get the post-mortem report that has been conducted. So if you can just answer us on that one. Then, Chairperson, if I can just, the regulation 15, no, the regulation 12, the dealing with disciplinary referrals and recommendations. I think you're opening yourself up for failure again. First of all, you don't refer to the Secretariat's responsibility in this case. So you're letting the Secretariat get in your way with it as well. Because we said, if you look at, you've got to read the Secretariat Act as well. We said the Secretariat's got a responsibility to make sure that, and follow up on recommendations and report also, there's got to be contact between IFAT and the Secretariat. It's not making provision for that. Secondly, do you believe that the regulation captures such adhering to your recommendations and that you're actually going to get feedback in terms of that, especially in terms of the history, knowing how subs deal with your recommendations? Then, Chairperson, lastly, and one from my regulation 15. I don't believe that is all that we want and that you should report in terms of your annual report to Parliament. This is a very cold and clinical given over of facts. We said to you when we drafted this bill that we now expect IFAD's recommendations to have an impact also on the way that SAPs operate. So surely you should yourself want to report to us recommendations that you've made in terms of operational issues regarding SAPs. In other words, as a result of, I saw you instruct the Durbanville Police Station because of the fact, I think it's Durbanville Police Station, of the cells being far from the police station, that there be permanent people deployed at the cell. Now, that would be an operational recommendation that can be then taken throughout the whole of the police service, and that does not have to be only with the Durbanville Police Station. So your recommendation can be wherever the cells are away from the police station, there should be permanent people deployed at the cells. And I think that is something that we start requiring of IPED as well, is not to only think about the case in front of you, but think about how you can impact on the work of the SAPs in total. That for me would be one of those issues where you must actually look at some of that. So I really believe 12 is not sufficient. You're going to come back to us and complain to us that it's not adhering to it. It's going to be your own fault because you're letting the Secretariat get in the way with it, and I believe you're still opening gaps for SAPs to just to ignore you. And then 15, Chair, I believe they should also report to us on the recommendations that impact on operational issues of the police.
Thank you, Chair. In light of the tenets of the IPED bill, have you at any stage begun an investigation into the actions surrounding on-again, off-again crime intelligence boss Richard and Lully? Because there is the claim of murder, there is the claim of fraud, there is the claim of the looting of the SAPS slush fund. So all these are criminal matters. I'm very interested to know whether you have utilised this new bill in that regard, new act. You were supposed to receive details, according to this and according to your regulations, all such matters from the SAPS. And he's a member of SAPS. Have you received any report, any information in this regard from anyone in SAPS? If you haven't, even been asked to investigate even a single one of these allegations, could you please explain why? What is the reasoning for that? And what steps have you taken in this regard, in that it seems there's a possibility you've been simply cut out of the loop altogether? You know, we've seen the man in and out of his job no fewer than six times at last count. So it does seem to reflect the possibility that he's somehow being protected. SAPS members must have known what was going on. One would imagine that would come into an investigation. Are they protecting criminality within the SAPS? That, I see, as your job. Your job, and as investigators, something you should be looking into. So I'm very interested in this, and if you haven't done anything in this regard, please explain why. Although it's almost inconceivable to me that you would sit here and tell us you've done nothing on what is possibly the highest profile case that SAT has had in a decade. Looking also at the matter of discipline of your own members, entrapment, of course it's a very effective tool. Has the process been utilized previously under the ICD? And my interest is your cooperation with the DPP. Is it adequate? Have you got a good working relationship? Is there any difficulty in your utilizing this tool to ferret out criminality within your own ranks? And then finally, and I know it's been covered to a certain extent, but we don't ever want to see the situation slide back to the days when the SAT simply ignored your recommendations. I know I complained about it year after year. I think they were up to ignoring at least or over 80% of your recommendations. It was an horrific situation. It was totally contemptuous, really. It's again, talking to Regulation 12, is Regulation 12 sufficiently detailed in this regard? I really am so fearful of any wiggle room allowed anywhere because of the history of SAPS ignoring your very existence. You would give very detailed recommendations and they would chuck them in the rubbish bin. And what we had, and I'm not sure that we don't still have it, but what we had then was what seemed to be a set of laws under the radar by which SAPS members were judged. And they were simply dealt with within the SAPS, and they never actually faced criminal charges, which any civilian would have faced in similar circumstances. So I'm very interested to hear exactly how tough this can be, and I'd like some input on this Regulation 12, please. Thank you.
Thanks, Chairperson. I have three short questions to ask. The first one is in line with what Honourable Annalisa said about the concern regarding accessibility of ICE offices. I'm sure there will be a need for an extensive public awareness campaign so that people will not only be informed about the whereabouts of these offices, but that they will be informed about how to report matters of corruption and misconduct among the police. Now, interestingly, this has just been stated that members of the public do not have to go via the SAPS office. Now, obviously, ordinary members will not be able to guess. They will not be able to know how to go about this. So I want to know whether there is any plan for this public awareness campaign to also educate people on how to go about laying complaints against misconduct among the police. The second one has to do with a charge discharging of a firearm and threatening a member of the public with that. What I want to know about this, where does the burden of proof lie? When there is a false allegation, for example, or a serious and a true allegation, how will IPID go about knowing who is right, on whom will the burden of proof lie, the accuser or the one who's accused? And thirdly, when it comes to cases of rape, the regulation there says that they must ensure that the victim is examined by a medical practitioner. But there is no time frame for them to know that there is urgency in the victim being medically examined. I would want to know why there is no time frame. How urgent is this when a person has been raped? On issues such as laying complaints, giving feedback, there are time frames, guidance is given. But on this one, which is also very important, guidance is not given. So I want to know whether this is not that important that it requires a time frame so that people do not wait for 2 weeks, for example, before they ensure that the victim is examined by a medical practitioner. Thank you.
Thanks, Jefferson. On Regulation 2, you said the complaint must be lodged in written of fact or electronically. Does it mean a person cannot personally go into the IPID offices to lodge a complaint? My second question is on the in this crime, different crimes require different investigative skills. And why do you have corruption, torture, rape by police in the same regulation? My third question is on this 90 days of finalizing the complaint. If an investigator has not reached the deadline, he must write some reasons. Now, what I want to know is how many times can you do that on the same matter? Can you write more than once the reasons on the same matter? Thanks, Chair.
Thanks, Chair. Let me take the opportunity to thank the presenters. Your process you followed in developing the regulation were very tense, let me put it that way. You're talking here about government departments and civil society organizations. To me, it's very important that you disclose the names of those departments and civil society organizations that you met with. Yes, also I have a concern, just like Honorable Olivati, that rape, torture, corruption is said easily. As it is a norm in police to commit these things. But this is, if a police person can commit this, a police person is a very special person in the life of the community, and he or she must live by example. Why should they commit all these things? Wave, what are you doing to curb or indoctrinate police not to commit all this? Abominable deeds. Okay. Other questions have been followed by my other members.
Chair,
Honorable George, Honorable Ndlovu, Honorable Ramatlakana, Honorable Grunewald, Honorable Bobin, Honorable Annelies, and let all.
Well, Madam Chair, to me it's not a question, but I think it's a better question because I'm worried about certain things that I hear that IT is going to be doing. Some of them are obligatory to the police. So I hope there will be no confusion that the police will not do what they are. For instance, visit the deceased next of kin to inform them. That's the responsibility of the police. So I don't want a situation where I think there's going to be clarity that you don't create a situation where somebody dies in the cell, the police don't inform the family because they are waiting for IP. If IP does that, I have no problem with that. But I think the police, because those are obligations, those are things that the police do now. And to me, they are correct, so it should not be changed. So I think we need to, for instance, ensure that the victim is examined by a medical. That's what the police are doing now. Anybody in South Africa who has not died of natural causes, police make sure that person is. I'm saying there should be no confusion. After this act, now police believe certain obligations which they have been, they, in terms of the law, are supposed to be doing, cannot do. The last part, Madam Chair, is just clarity. Death as a result of police action. Are you saying to me you're going to investigate every death as a result? I'm just having in mind. Here is a, what do you call it, in transit, what is action between the police, the robbery, big robbery of the bank, between, and then there's a confrontation between the police and dangerous criminals, and there's an exchange of fire. Are you going to investigate if one of the criminals is killed? Are you going to investigate that? Because that's for clarity, because I want to know, because you only have a lot of work to do, from what I see, in terms of the behavior of the police. But I also wouldn't like a situation where you investigate everything. You see, because what the IT is, it's the responsibility to make sure that the police do their work. But also, it should not be also to intimidate the police not to do even what they are supposed to be doing. You know, in the 90s, we had a problem, especially after Section 1949, was amended. There was a problem. Police didn't even know to act. They didn't even went to shoot until it took us a meeting, road shows to show them. But there's nothing that says you should not shoot if your life is your life is under threat. But you can only shoot because what that section and amendment was aimed at is to make sure that police don't shoot a young boy, as you normally use, who has stolen a chocolate from Checkers and is running away with a chocolate from Checkers. I'm not saying people must steal chocolate from Checkers, but if a young boy steals a chocolate from Checkers, is run away, and the police say stop or I'll shoot, and the boy does not stop. We think that is what it was meant to stop. Stop shooting unnecessary and what one call harmless citizen. But I want to check, does this mean are you going to wait every day as a result of police action, even where the police had to shoot back to kill, and probably with the, because you must understand police are not soldiers. They shoot to disarm or load, but surely, when there's police action between hardened criminals, especially in a bank robbery or something like that, they might be there. Are you going to investigate them?
Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Chairperson, most of the questions that I wanted to ask have been asked by my colleagues, but there is one thing that worries me. There are time frames that are being put in these regulations. I just want to ask one question. Are they compatible to the human resource you have? Because if you talk about 24 hours, and you talk about 48 hours, and you talk about reporting within a period of some sort, is your human resource compatible to the time frame that you have put forward? So that you don't put things here, which is a pie in the sky, that cannot be implemented. And at the end of the day, people are querying you and say that you have promised to do this, but we are not reporting it back. That's the first question. The second question, Chairperson, is reporting to the, or going back to the complainant and reporting to the complainant of what is going on about his or her case. Are you quite sure that that can be implemented? And it should be implemented. Are you quite sure that will be implemented? And do you have a human resource that is compatible to what we are saying in this regulation? That every now and then the case has to be reported to the person who has complained about it within a period of time. If you are not sure of that, can we talk about your human resource and compare to the time frame you have and compare to what you are giving us here? If it's not compatible, it won't haunt you tomorrow and say that we have put things that you can't acquire to do at the end of the day. Thanks, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair. Just a few questions, small questions. The first one is in follow-up to the Regulation 2, where you deal with the form. I think there's a Form 2 there. It's not clear from the explanation in terms of public, member of public. Is it a requirement that they do? What's going to happen in a remote area when members of public want to report and access? So I just want to find that the requirement of the Form 2 that we have in the regulation, on that Regulation 2, that form that we have there. And then the one question is in terms of Regulation 4, you have there 90 days and you have the bolded wording that within 30 days of the investigation of the designation, certain things have to be done, the issue about reconstruction of the scene and so on. I just want to find out the period that you're prescribing, the 30 days that you say within 30 days. Now, on matters like what you described there, in order to reconstruct the scene and be able to get the information, you have to do it fairly quicker than later. So I'm just wondering to understand what the 30 days, whether you'll be able to achieve what you want to achieve. And within the 90 days that you are talking about here in terms of finalization, we're moving to 90 days from what? What is the current requirement now? I'm asking this because, I mean, there was a matter in Nyanga last year, December, where there were, I think, 3 deaths in December in the cell. When I tried to establish the facts of what has happened in May, beginning of May, about the information around that, there was still not, the information I received was that there is a delay with the information of tests that has been done. They don't get the results in order to determine the cause of death in terms of the cause. So, I mean, that's 5 months, almost 6 months down the line. I just want to understand what is the, where we're moving from to 90 days. I think the Regulation 5, it is good to venture in dealing with the issue of corruption, but I just investigate that. But I just want to understand from the director, you think the what you have currently? Does it give sufficient capacity and power to be able to venture in this field of investigation, or in terms of the police corruption, in which areas? Because I think there's some. I think Honourable Member Colaban had asked the previous questions. I'm asking the question in terms of venturing in this, which is a good thing. Do you have the tools to be able to do that, what you're saying you're going to be able to do in terms of the regulation here? The last one is the regulation 16, Honourable Chair. I'm just wondering to find out. There is a legislation that regulates that in power iPad to do X, Y, Z. I just want to find out the protocol you're talking about. You mentioned in there that the protocol is under discussion between the police and municipal police. That's all you say, and I'm not seeing any objective of this protocol. What is it that it seeks to achieve, given the legislative responsibility that you have currently in terms of the iPad? The last one. I think it's good, lots of good things in the regulation. Do you have the capacity to do what you are saying, you're prescribing in the regulation that you're able to do? So that tomorrow when we come back here, we don't say that we did not ask this particular question. What is written here? Do you have the capacity to be able to implement?
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, what is important for me is the public, and I think it links up with what the Honourable Van Dijk has said. If I look at your Form 2, I want to ask certain questions, because, Chairperson, what is going to happen in practice is that if a person or a member from the public wants to lay a complaint, we must make it very user-friendly for that specific person, because I think the majority of the complaints will come from the public. And we must know, Chairperson, that if a member of the public lays a complaint against a police member, for that person it is quite a traumatic experience. It's not easy for people to lay charges. And if I look at your Form 2, I want to ask firstly, when it comes with the details of the victim, I don't see that we have an ID number there, a column for that. We ask for a passport number, but not everybody's got a passport. I don't know. It's good if you have a passport, but why don't we provide for an ID number column there as well? And even at the end, Chairperson, if you look at the details of the witnesses, you have the title and the surname and a landline and a cell phone number, but telephone numbers can change overnight. I would also ask that we also add there a column for an ID number, because a specific incident took place, you've got a witness, and if you've got an ID number which you can put in the Part 2 form, then it is more easily traceable if something happens. And then lastly, Chairperson, I would like to see at the end of that form that we provide the fax numbers as well as the email addresses where you can send the complaint. Because the public, now they've completed the form, now what? Now they hand it over to the officer in the police station. Are they going to get the receipt or what? That we add in India all the provincial fax numbers and the email numbers so that the member of the public knows exactly what he or she must do and where he or she can send the complaint. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Chairperson, and all the presenters. Chairperson, my question is on, my first question is on regulation number 8 on slide number 20. Procedure on securing the crime scene. What I'd like to find out here is the time frame. How long would it take or how long is it expected to take for the person to be at the crime scene, for the person to collect that evidence? And then that would take me to the question that was asked by Honorable Mission with regard to the availability of human power. Do you think you have enough human power to execute that or those tasks? Believing that these crimes not only happen at police stations or closer, they might happen at a distance, but as a result of police action. Would, this is an experience that I once had, where there was this accident, this person died, the scene was cordoned timelessly, but the people who were supposed to come and take the evidence took more than 4 hours. So what would be your time, your response time to the crime scene? That's my question. The other one is on slide number 9. Death as a result of police action. So I'm asking myself, didn't the directorate find it necessary to qualify that death as a result of police action? Whether it would be because of a police action being on duty or off duty. So that's what I want to find out. Didn't you find it important to qualify that death as a result of police action? Thanks.
Yeah, Chairperson, just one question that I forgot is, I'm worried about the regulations that we're ignoring the MSPs, the MPSs, the Municipal Police Services, in terms of the regulations. Because if you look at the regulations, there are places where we refer to the Municipal Police Services, but then there are sections where we don't refer to the Municipal Police Services. For instance, their obligation to report, their obligation to on the recommendations that you send out. There's nothing in terms of the Municipal Police Services. I think there's something, I think also partly the blame lies with us. I don't think we've been explicit enough in the act as well around it. But the fact of the matter is the MPS, I think we might get to an end where we know you haven't been focusing on MPS. But we might again create a situation where they then just fall by the byside. And I'm specifically worried about the obligation on them in terms of your recommendations.
No, thank you very much, members. I think ICB preempted our questions by first listing the principles for the drafting of regulations, which I think it is important for us to remember that these are authorized by the Enabling Act, that is the Act itself. So some of the things that are in these regulations are supposed to be in the Act itself. The time frames, your 24 hours, your 48, this is what we probably may have said, we have said as members of Parliament, and therefore their regulations must talk to this. However, I also have a question on your receiving, registering, processing, referral, and disposing of complainants. You have said 312, a complaint which falls outside the ambit of the said provision must within 7 days of receipt or referral, as the case may be referred in writing to an appropriate authority or institution that is capable of dealing with such a complaint. 7 days. And then you are saying the complainant must within 7 days be informed in writing and, if practicable, telephonically of such referral. Are you therefore saying 14 days? You know, I report a case to you and it's a case, probably it will be a criminal case. When it takes 7 days, I'm just asking. When you have said yourself you must be able to deal with them within 48 hours, within 24 hours, when you have said staff must be able to inform you within 24 hours, but if it comes to you by mistake, maybe lack of information, you are saying now it's yourself 7 days. But giving feedback to this person, you are saying, no, it will be 7 days. And I'm not very sure to whether that 7 days is within that very first 7 days or it's an added 7 days to make it 14. And somebody at that time is expecting the case to be in court if it is a criminal case. Maybe one other question I have on, I think it is 3, what is it, investigation of death in police custody or as a result of police action. You are saying an investigator designated in terms of sub-paragraph, sub-regulation 2 must, as soon as is practicable, but within 24 hours of designation, authorize, that is the, authorize the removal of the corpse in consultation with a pathologist, if a pathologist is available. Well, if not available, what then? What will happen if the pathologist is not available? Because now the regulation does not say anything as to what then will happen in that event. Also, just the F of that, I think it's a question that was asked by Honorable Blue Lecture, visit the deceased's next of kin to inform them of the death and to obtain statements that may assist in the investigation. You visit and you not even say, cause, make it happen. You know, you're not accommodating any possibility of somebody doing it on behalf so that the investigator make it happen that happens. And what if that somebody is in Limpopo and the next of kin is in the Western Cape? Are we saying that person will have to fly or drive from Limpopo to the Western Cape, or that person can make that happen, that the next of kin in the Western Cape is informed? But according to the regulation, it does seem like it has got to be that person and nothing else. On the question of post-mortem and who should be there, I think as asked by Honorable Mulek George, my question would be probably to say, why should there be somebody in the post-mortem? Because that is going to assist us in responding. A post-mortem first, it will be for all unnatural deaths, I want to believe. And then secondly, there will be a policeman, and you are saying in this case, if there will be your investigators present. And maybe to respond to that question would be to say, why are they there? Why it is important for them to be there? So that we therefore know as to who should be present between yourself and the SAPS member. And remember, this case is a SAPS case. I think I had another question. If not, that is that. But maybe I just want to add on Honorable Kwalakwa's question on whether you are also dealing with General Mdluli's issue. But furthermore, to brief us on what is happening with the Katomano and General Buizen's matter, the three of them, because that is what we asked, so that we are briefed by yourself. Thank you.
May I just ask just one quickly that I've gotten about? It's just, if you could just fill me in your press briefing yesterday, you referred to Section 29 of the IPED Act, and I'm very interested in that you said there are definitely cases already of late reporting, non-reporting of theft criminality. You have the power to arrest. Could you fill us in on specific cases where this has been ignored and what you've done about it? Are there SAPS members looking to be arrested? This is new. You're just off the starting block, and I'm very keen to see the sort of impact you're going to have on the SAPS. Are they going to take you seriously? This is your moment to make your mark. And if they're ignoring you now, and you said since the beginning of April we've noticed an increase reporting, however, and it's the however I'm worried about. So I want to know if you've brought up the stick yet. Thank you.
No, I think that's a question also I'm interested in. In fact, it also talks to the absence of a regulation in this matter. I'm not sure there's an omission to say. how do they do it? I mean, do they know as to what to do, your investigators, when it comes to their attention?
I think a very important issue that I forgot here as well is the ACMAX provision that you can refer complainants to other bodies if it doesn't fall under yourself. Do you not think it's necessary that you put in the regulations that you keep record of those references? So with other words, that if you have received a complaint, you've referred that complaint to the Human Rights Commission, for instance, that you can keep record of that so that when the complainant comes back to you and says, ICED is not doing its work, you can actually show that you have referred it to another body. So I just think it is important for completeness of complaints as well that we do have record of where you are referring people to.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much. Executive Director, we are going to break for a tea. Time now is 11:15. Half past 11, you start answering questions. Whether members are sitting or not sitting in front of you, whether the chairperson is there or not, you start talking. We'll break for tea.
We believe that the questions also, I think, play a positive role in going forward. Chairperson, maybe just to indicate that you also indicated at the start of the presentation, and I think Mr. Ramatlakane, Honourable Member, also referred to time frames, the scheme of the regulations and where we come from. Honourable Chairperson and members will remember, the pre-IPED era, there was the SAPS Act Chapter 10. At that stage, there was no standing operating procedures in the ICD when I came in 2009. Now, currently, there's five instruments that we can utilize to ensure that there's proper governance and also accountability by the South African Police and the Municipal Police Service. The one, of course, is the IPED Act, and quite importantly, I think also the Honourable Chairperson referred to it, that the regulations may not increase the ambit, scope or purpose of this Act. So that's very important. That is the ground norm for us moving forward. Then the regulations that we currently have, and I think we've got valuable input from the members, especially in terms of especially the liaison with the public and complaints. And the regulations normally would be in place for a year, and then it will be a proper evaluation and amendments. But there's three other instruments, and we believe that we can also utilize to supplement maybe the lacunas. The one is the ED guidelines, where there's provision in the Act for that. And then we believe the ED guidelines can be used to supplement the lacunas to ensure that there's proper accountability, but then also the memorandum of understanding between us, the MPS and SAPS. There was previously a memorandum of understanding in place in terms of the old ICD operation, and we believe a lot of the issues, especially the practical issues, apart from the SOPs, so that memorandum of understanding is critical in terms of that, to include that. And then finally, the standing operating procedures, where we in detail deal with the practical investigations, the liaison with family, all those issues we deal with in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act. So we believe, especially the recommendations that we received this morning, Chairperson, from the members, what we will do, what we will undertake from our side, is that we will prepare a compendium from all the input and then come back with the committee in terms of ED guidelines that we then can supplement the regulations with to ensure that those issues are included. Especially the issues of accessibility of the public, we agree with honourable members in indicating that we can maybe supplement the current regulations. So that's quite important. I'll ask the other colleagues to then deal with the specific questions. Maybe the chairperson asked the progress regarding Kaita Manor. Maybe just to indicate that the team is still busy with the investigation. We anticipate that they will complete it quite soon, and of course then it depends on the Director of Public Prosecutions in terms of going forward. So I'll ask Mr. Sorko to start with the specific questions.
Thank you, Chairperson, honourable members. I think most of the question raised by members, especially Honourable Van Wyk. I think these are valid inputs that you gave us, and we really appreciate them. Like the executive director has indicated, we will then go back to the office and ensure that these are included in our ED guidelines. And then when we do the review of the regulations, then we will include them again. All these issues regarding Section 33, regarding regulation for special investigations, the issue of registration of exhibits, ensuring that we are done that way, the issue of the role of the Secretariat in helping us enforcing the recommendations, the reporting on the recommendations themselves. All these issues, we'll take them together, make sure that they are in the regulations, I mean in the ED guidelines for now, and then when we then review the regulations, then we will definitely include them. And we appreciate these inputs. I think the process that we followed, we tried to be as extensive as possible, but clearly, you know, sometimes we miss some of these things, so we really appreciate these inputs. With regard to the investigation on General Mdluli, the investigation, remember, were conducted by the Hawks, were already started by the Hawks before the IPID. And when the IPID came into effect, these matters were already before our court. So, in our view, at the time when the Hawks engaged in these investigations, there was no IPID implementation at the time. So, there was no reporting obligation per se, or the section, the IPID legislation did not preclude them, or did not enforce on us to get involved at the time. But also because when we came into the IPID, the matters are already before our court. We felt that since they are already before our court, then the investigation has already been done, and we did not get involved in that regard. And especially also that the involvement also of the Inspector General, because of the nature of those allegations. You also asked whether there was a process.
Before we move on, surely, I mean, you read the papers as everybody else does. This matter's been on the front page now, week in, week out, for months. I don't know, and in that it was all these cases were mysteriously dropped, and now they're called to reinvestigate, etc. I actually don't believe there is no role for you to play. It is still a major, major issue, and I'm fully aware that the Secretary General of Intelligence is apparently doing her investigation. That isn't, again, close to intelligence. No one will ever know what comes out of that. No one will see it. No one will hear the results. But we're talking about basic criminality that I still believe you should be investigating. It went through the court. It didn't go to the court. It was all mysteriously dropped. Isn't that something leaves the door open for you still to investigate these matters? I mean, murder is murder is murder. I don't know that that simply saying it's done, it's not done. It has never been done, and it is still being investigated by certain people. But I also believe your job is to investigate criminality within the SAPS, and that most certainly qualifies as criminality by a SAPS member.
There are two hands on that, but I just want to remind members that there is an inquest on this one. Very legitimate process. The judge will preside, he will gather information, and he will pronounce himself as to whether there is any prima facie evidence. I don't believe that I think ICT might respond for itself, but I just want to remind members that there is an inquest already. It will be in September. For me, that is the most legitimate process that is coming on issues related to murder allegations. I just want to remind members on that too. For myself, I'm really looking forward to that, because I believe that if anybody was murdered, it is only fair for the family to know as to who is responsible for that murder. And it is only fair for the perpetrator to face the law and be, if he's found guilty, to go to jail. And for me, that is important. It doesn't matter as to who that person is. There is a family that is aggrieved, there is a family that lost a father, a son, a husband, and so on. It is fair for that family to know as to who murdered that person, because indeed there was a person who died. So that's my take. 1999, NPA declined to prosecute, but there is an inquest. I just want to remind members that there is indeed an inquest. Good, as I'm not saying AIP should not get involved, but I just want to remind members that there is an inquest that all of us are looking forward to. I'm just saying that.
I may agree absolutely with you. I agree 100% that there isn't any more downgraded, but it is an inquest. But there are certainly plenty of other charges, masses of charges, which do not relate to the murder, which include basic fraud and theft and corruption and looting of funds and money that do not belong to this man, and the links with many others that certainly should be investigated. They are all SAPS members who've had their fingers in this till. So I was not referring to, you know, I absolutely not one can't interfere with the inquest investigation and results, but the rest, I believe they should be doing that.
I did not, when you, in your closing remarks, the question raised this matter of General Duri. You know, when a chairperson speaks, you don't want to interfere. But I would have loved to persuade this portfolio committee that saying that we have agreed now, chairperson has also said that we have asked for an urgent meeting with the police. That's why I even suggested, probably because of the things which we have heard, the issues of also the letters that are flying around, threats by the Minister of, home settlement, eh? Yeah, for human settlement. You change the department so quick that the time to get lost. I'm saying, Madam Chair, I can't answer for IP, but my advice would be, seeing that we've agreed on this meeting, why don't we wait for this meeting so that we get everything? That's why I even suggested that even if the minister stays for 30 minutes to tell us, because there are certain issues that are not with this guy, they were let us into these allegations and that. That's why I think if we get this information, because at that meeting, if the Acting National Commission, surely even the people like Hawks and so will be there. So that we get all this information at that time, we are able to ask questions rather than asking IPED, which even if it is done, if you leave that, you must understand once it's a criminal case and they are all linked, it's going to be very difficult for any institution just to say, I know, we're not investigating this one, Tina, we're investigating this. It does not work like that. Thank you. That's why my plea with us, Madam Chair, you people believe that if you don't get this information, there will be some death. I would like already threatened by death. 8 in the morning, my friend says he's going to die. I don't want another one to die. Only one person. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Chairperson, I think you've dealt with the issue at the beginning of the meeting when you said that, you know, we will have the special meeting. And as you say, you know, there is an inquest, and in terms of the funding also, I think, and IPED has made this point on previous occasions in the media, if I'm not mistaken, that the Inspector General are the one that are tasked with secret funds, because as much as we are not privilege to what happens with the secret funds. Neither, I believe, is ARPIT privilege to what happens to the secret funds. Mm-hmm. But I also want to add, Jefferson, to what you've been saying. Nothing stops ARPIT now to register themselves as an interested party in the inquest and to be there in the inquest and to play the role that they're supposed to be playing in the inquest. So, you know, I think that point we take, and we would like to take, put that point forward to ICED as well. Not taking over the investigation, but you've got a responsibility as well in terms of that.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think the inputs are noted. There was a question with regard to entrapment, whether we utilized this before. The ICED legislation did not make provision for integrity. I mean, the ICD legislation did not make provision for the integrity testing processes. So it's only now that we will get involved with this integrity testing process within in line with the ICED legislation and the regulation. And then, Honorable Mishwe had concern with regard to access and public awareness. And we can indicate that we have an extensive program for public awareness for this current financial year. And part of our engagement also with our other partners, the SAPS and the MPS, is that we should also jointly do this public awareness to make our communities aware of these changes in mandates. And we note the concern with regard to whether, and this question was also asked by Honorable Engi, whether person cannot complain. Complainants cannot come direct to our office and complain. And we noted the lacuna in the regulations which will address. But currently, the complainants are still continuing to complain to us as they used to, in respect of all criminal offences and misconduct. And where we receive cases of service delivery, they are referred to the appropriate institutions. And this brings me also to the issue of whether on the issues of referrals, that our case management system made provision for also those referrals so that we have a record of these referrals in our system. So that at any given time we can be able to, at the click of a button, indicate what referrals we made to which organizations. However, as we indicated previously, the issue of aligning our regulations to that is something that we will deal with. There was a question on time frames with regard to rape or with regard to examination of rape victims. In terms of our investigation procedures, immediately a rape case is reported to us. We have to attend the crime scene at the time when it's reported to us, if there is such a crime scene. Our investigators are very much aware that immediately on arrival at the scene, on interaction with the victim, they must comply with the legislation as provided for in the Sexual Offences Act by ensuring that the victim immediately gets the necessary medical attention. So that is something that we are already doing. We've already received some rape cases, and in all these cases, we have ensured that this is done. There was a question with regard to torture. Why torture, corruption, and assault are in one regulation? This is one thing that we've also noted and said something that we'll look at. At the time when we created these regulations, we looked at them as all criminal offences, and hence they were classified as such. The only one that was separated was death as well as discharge, because discharge was a new creation in terms of ICED legislation. Honorable Lecato wanted us to disclose the name of organizations we interacted with at the time of the development of these regulations. I don't think we have the names now, but it's the information that you can provide the committee, because we have the record of those. And the other question was, what is it that we are doing to stop police from torturing our communities? Currently, we would investigate all the cases that we receive, and our expectation is that they also report these matters to us. Part of the strategy that we thought we would do is also visiting police cells to see if we can get cases of such abuses, and then so that we'll be able to deal with those cases. Honorable George had concerns about the visit by our investigators to the next of kin, whether we're not taking the responsibility of the police. Our visit to the next of kin does not preclude the police from discharging their own responsibilities. From our perspective, is that the visit is part of our investigation processes. When a person is deceased, most of the time you also get information about what could have happened from the family, but also to be able to inform the family of our role as IPID, and so that they are aware that we will be doing the investigation of those matters. So in some instances, you find that when you visit the family, you find the police have already done so, but it's just to reinforce our role as IPID. And where we find that the police have not yet visited the family, we will then still do our part in terms of informing the family, but importantly also our role and indicating what processes we're going to engage in terms of investigating, requesting families if they've got any further information with regard to the case, so that you can take the investigation forward. Honourable George also wanted clarity with regard to whether we do investigate every death as a result of police action, even though there's a robbery and there's clear criminality and the police were involved with criminals in a shootout. The answer to that, Honourable George, is that we do investigate that, because it's in the Act that we must investigate that. Our role is to make a finding whether that death was justified or not. Honourable Ndlovu raised concern with regard to time frames, whether they are compatible with our human resource. The Honourable Chairperson also alluded to the fact that some of these issues with regard to time frames and so forth, these are the inputs also that we got from the committee. And these are the things that we do specifically, that we don't want our cases to go on for a long time without finalization. But also, when you look at the regulations, they make provision that where this, because in the nature of investigation, sometimes we may not be able to complete investigation within these time frames. And that's why the regulations make provision that where this, in cases where this cannot happen, an investigator must then give written reasons why it could not happen within those required time frames. So we think that it is important that we do that. And the reporting to complainants on a monthly basis, I think it stems from the fact that we must keep our complainants abreast. I mean, in the ICD environment, for instance, most of the service delivery cases that we are receiving against the police were precisely about them not giving feedback to the complainant. So we're trying to say in IPID that we want to ensure that our investigators give this feedback to our complainants and next of kin on a regular basis. Also, our flow-centric system is able to track that, whether we actually do give this monthly feedback to complainants, and we can be able from management draw reports that indicates whether this is done or not, and if not done, we do the necessary intervention. Honorable Ramatlakane raised, I think, was the issue of access. Again, I've already alluded to it, and the issue of 30 days with regard to matters that were not reported or where there was late reporting. I think the thrust of this regulation is that where there is non-reporting, we need to expedite that investigation in terms of trying to get all the things that we could have done had we attended the scene within this time frames. And then process of investigation will also be able to tell us in terms of when we're doing a full investigation, where to go or where not to go. So basically the 30-day time frame is to try to get us to speed up this investigation, because there was no reporting at all in this situation. So I think that is the issue with regard to that regulation for.
We dealt with the issue of the pathologies and your presence and the role. You didn't touch it.
Okay, the issue of the pathologist, where I think the question was we must inform the pathologist when we clear the scene or in consultation with the pathologist. And the question was, what if the pathologist is not there? I think this is the decisions that are made by an investigator in consultation with the provincial head at that time. It is not always possible to have a pathologist in all the crime scenes that the IPID will visit. So sometimes the corpses will be removed in the absence of the pathologist, but arrangement normally would have been made with regard to the corpse going to the mortuary and the aid when the postmortem will be held. I think this ties in also with the question with regard to what is it that we do when we attend the postmortem. Because we attended the scene, we identify issues that needs to be investigated at the crime scene level in terms of also observing the wounds of the deceased and so forth. It is the responsibility of the investigator when he arrives at the postmortem to advise the pathologist who conducts the postmortem in terms of the investigative issues that he feels are important that the pathologist must look at. An example is where, for instance, there's an allegation of torture. Where there's an allegation of torture, normally wounds are not visible. So it therefore becomes important for the IPID investigator to advise the pathologist what those allegations are and where to look for possible wounds that may not be easily identifiable. And that is where, for instance, you find the pathologist will open up the corpse to look behind the skin for this kind of injuries. So basically it's to advise the pathologist in terms of investigative clues that we may know that the pathologist must look for when conducting the postmortem.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was...
So what you are saying is that your investigator
will use his or her discretion to decide what to do at a time where there is no pathologist available. As a matter of fact, in many areas of the country, there won't be a pathologist available to come to the crime scene. Even in the cities here in Cape Town, for instance, there might be a pathologist, but for him to be available to come to the crime scene, that could be something else. But then you have your rural areas where the, something called pathologist is something unknown. You have just a doctor from a hospital who will conduct autopsy. He's not a pathologist, he's a medical doctor. And are you therefore saying the your investigator will use his discretion or will phone the head of department or what actually will happen? But how are they going to know what to do if there is nothing guiding them in that regard? I'm just asking.
Thank you, Chairperson. With regard to cases of death as a result of police action or death in custody, there is also a circular from Department of Health that those postmortem must be conducted by pathologists. So even in rural areas, we would then, if there is no pathologist near, we would then ensure that the body is transported to the nearest place where there is a pathologist. Sometimes the pathologist will then go to that place. It depends on the arrangements that are being made. So it's just compliance. You do find in some instances where maybe the district surgeon is not aware of that, and sometimes we had situations where we had some altercations because we insisted that the pathologist must do the postmortem and not a district surgeon.
Probably, I think we should do, but you see, I'm just worried about IP doing something which fixing a car which is, does not need fixing. The issue of pathologists, how they work in a specific moment, as I have observed, it works perfectly. Firstly, they are rare skills. They are not, you're not going to find that they're in one, a pathologist, there is a place. Somebody dies out of unnatural cause. The police know that person, before everything is done, is the pathologist, there's a place where the pathologists go and do their work. So this thing that you can find pathologists in crime is not practical. But you see, I'm worried about putting certain things which you know that practically you will not be able, so that when you are cornered by a lawyer in a criminal case, they say, no, you did, according to your own regulations, you said there will be a pathology. No, it was not practical. You see, because this issue of pathology, as far as I'm concerned, it is working. I'm talking within the police. With what, even what the chaplain was saying, I'm not sure I agree with the absolute case, but the problem that the police have on that one, it is working very, it's working very well. There's no problem with it. So, and in my view, I think they must fit in that one, because that's why I was interested. What are they going to do? They want presence. They are present. That's a qualified pathologist. Of course, I'm told by Annelies that that's what we wrote in the law. I was there when all this, I might have missed some of these things were sneaked in by Annelies. But I would still don't understand why there should be the presence of IP or anybody when the pathologist is doing his or her job. Because they are qualified. They do the job what they know. And I have never heard in South Africa that there was a pathologist who gave a wrong information. So why should they be monitored by people first who are not even qualified? I don't know, these investigating officers of ICT, what do they know about how person has died and all the medical issues?
Chairperson, I will forgive the Honourable Mululeki for thinking that I slipped something in. At least you fall asleep sometimes even during the day, so I understand him saying that he might have missed some of these issues. Jefferson, I think we need to be, and I think that's what I try to explain to us, it's not uncommon for investigators to be present when pathologists do the work. It's a common practice. Even the detectives in SAS, when they're dealing with an issue, would be present when the pathologist is doing their job. I think that is basically what they were trying to say to us. So it's not uncommon. It might be, and I agree, unrealistic to think you're going to have a pathologist at the scene. The body will be moved to where the pathologist will be, and it might even be there for a day or two or three before the pathologist actually give attention to it. But, I mean, it's not uncommon for that to happen. So I don't think we must spend more time on this issue.
In fact, we're taking it too far. Because the question was on the removal of the corpse, authorize the removal of the corpse in consultation with the pathologist, if a pathologist is available. And for me, it was like from the crime scene, removing it, to say how practical that is. And if it is not, what then should be? Are we leaving it in the discretion of an investigator? That is the question. And really, whether they should be present in the autopsy or during the autopsy or not, I mean, really, it's like a doctor seeing a patient in the consulting room. The nurse will be there, and that is all. There will be the two of them, so that if the patient says, no, this is what he has done, there's somebody to say, no, but it didn't happen. Just that. As simple as all that. But I think the question was in saying, you are saying in consultation with, he may not be there, may not even be able to phone him, unless we acknowledge the fact that doctors study diseases anyway. Doctors study diseases because pathologists study diseases. So doctors too do that extensively. Are we saying doctors as well and so on and so forth? I hear you talking about the Department of Health. I come from rural area, I still have to say pathologist in Nambuleni or in my area. It's doctors that every day on Thursday, Nambuleni Hospital are performing autopsies or postmortem. It's like that, otherwise people would not be buried. Simple and all that. I don't know what the Department of Health has said, but if that was the case, people will never be buried because there isn't a pathologist in that area. It's doctors, Ambulance employed, who on this day, in the morning, they go to mortuary and they conduct those, and people take their relatives on Friday. Simple as all that. And that is all. And they are, in any event, they've studied pathology, that is the diseases, the pathology of the condition. They've studied that, that is doctors. But I was just asking on just that one to say, what if it's not, is it, are we leaving, are you leaving it in the discretion of the investigator? That is all. I think it was a simple question. But maybe because you have allowed me to talk, you also are referring to the, after collecting all evidence and statements, submit a report to the provincial head or executive director. Somewhere, I think, as I was reading, it was like, it's possible that the director will delegate somebody to investigate and therefore will have to report to the director. Is this what you are saying? That at provincial level, Mpumalanga province, the case that, for instance, I requested the ICD to IPIT to investigate, whoever is investigating will have to report back direct to the executive director and not to the province. And what will that mean to the provincial statistics and investigations? I'm just checking. Because it's like, it can either be, it's this or that. Will it not be that any case investigated in a province is reported to the provincial head, who then will inform the executive head? Should it be the investigator who decides? Because I'm instructed, therefore I will decide. I'm not sure as to what this is supposed to mean. I just wanted to check because it says executive director or head of province. It's like at that level, the investigator can choose to report to either this one or that one. And what will that mean to the province and the statistics at that level and the reporting and keeping of records?
Thank you, Chairperson. I think what that means, and maybe it's how it's captured, what that means is that, like in the case you referred to earlier, remember when the referral comes from the executive director, goes directly to the provincial head. who then designate an investigator to investigate. The report then comes from investigator to the provincial head, who must look at the report, once happy with the report, then refer the report to the executive director. So the report cannot go to the executive director without being seen by the provincial head. And the process is that once the executive director refers, the province will then start first by registering that complaint if it was not yet registered, and do the necessary investigation, and then the reporting will go through that protocol.
I'll read this one to you. It says the executive director or the relevant provincial head, as the case may be, must designate an investigator to investigate the death of a person. And then coming back, it will then say the investigator will report to the executive director or the head of the province. It's like at that level of the investigator, you can decide to say, in any event, I was delegated by the executive director, and therefore I'm reporting direct to the executive director. That is what I'm saying. It's all. It's not giving a line of communication to say, even if it was the executive director, but you're still going to report back to your provincial head, who will then report to the executive director. It's not saying that in the regulations. That's what I'm saying.
I accept that, Honorable Chair, and in practice, however, it's done the way I've indicated, and we will also deal with that issue moving forward. There was also a question with regard to the protocol. Since there is legislation, why do we have to have a protocol? I think the protocol is basically to operationalize the Act so that all parties know exactly what their role is and how their involvement should be in terms of that. There was an issue that, for instance, Honorable Van Wyk raised with regard to the ignoring of the MPS, which we acknowledge. Mm-hmm. However, the protocol also comes in there because the MPS is part of that, to close in terms of Section 29, the reporting obligation. Those are the things that we also including in the protocol. So it will be like a stopgap to this lacuna that we've identified, which we undertook that we will close. Yeah, I think colleagues can take care of other.
Chair, before Mr. Sissoko goes off, I wanted to make a follow-up. Yes, you were saying in curbing rape, corruption, and torture, you will continue investigation. You see, but I thought that also at the entry level, when these people are being trained, your training should also try and curb. I'm just trying to check whether your training is talking to these incidents of rape, torture, in curbing at the entrance point. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Member Mr. We, in fact, have already started with the training on torture, corruption, and sexual offenses. Our program, the first group, I think, ended their program last week. We've got four groups, and then it will go on until, I think, around August, different groups coming through on that training. So it's something that we do, and one of the things that we're doing, we are developing a training manual which will talk specifically to all this Section 28 offences, so that we are able to develop our investigators to a capacity where they'll be able to deal easily with this. We are also looking at the possibility of having an IPID qualification in terms of investigation. So these are the things that we're looking at.
Let
this is also said in line with what the Honourable Legato has been asking. I think also the fact of the matter is what he's asking comes into the relates to the issue that we've raised around recommendations. So that for instance, if over a long period of time I did find that because of recruitment policies, that's why these things are happening. They will then make a recommendation for two steps to adjust the recruitment policies. I'm just making an example, because it won't be their responsibility. Theirs would be to make recommendations to rectify the situation.
Yeah, Honourable Chairperson, maybe on that point, I think that's where the legislation makes provision for the forum between us and the Secretariat. And after quarter one, that next month, we'll have to sit down with them and say, well, this is the number of recommendations in terms of 28th. And this is the trends we're picking up. So I think that should be the route.
Thanks, Nama. There was also a question raised with regard to the time frames in as far as the investigation with regard to Regulation 4 is concerned. Between the 24 hours that the investigator is expected to do certain things vis-a-vis the 90 days period in terms of which the investigation should be completed. The thinking behind the 24 hours was mostly to take care of a situation where at the scene all the witnesses are there. When the investigator arrives, everybody is there. The investigator should be able to identify people who have seen what happened, and the investigator should be able to take statements from these witnesses because they are already there in the scene instead of waiting for longer. But that does not necessarily, it was not the intention of the regulation to say that all these activities that have been outlined here have to be done within the 24 hours. But what is certain for sure is that at least the scene has to be attended within 24 hours. The latest time, and the details of the deceased have to be recorded. But the entire investigation, the identification of other witnesses and the taking of other statements and the identification of other evidentiary material that may be needed, that can still be done within the 90 days. And it might not necessarily be as clear as it is supposed to be in the regulations, but the clarity is provided for in the standard operating procedures as to what are the negotiables and what are the non-negotiables in terms of what they have to do immediately. And with regard to the issue of time frames in cases of rape for the examination of victims, we have made reference in the regulations to the Sexual Offences Act, and the provisions of that act, in terms of the provisions of that act, a person has to be examined, or the safest period within which a person has to be examined is within 72 hours. And that's the time frame within which we drafted the regulations. But what we may need to do in order to articulate that particular time frame clearly, we then outline that in the ED guidelines. With regard to the question on the qualification of death as a result of police action, the answer to that question is found in Section 28. Unfortunately, Section 28 splits the two. It's death as a result of police action or death in police custody. So we needed to make sure that we carry through that particular thread into the regulation. The issue on the fact that the regulations do not seem to talk directly to members of the municipal police service, the point is taken that we may need to beef them up. However, the thinking was that due to the fact that this particular regulation, Regulation 2, in as far as reporting obligations is concerned, stems from Section 29, Subsection 1, which categorically states that both members of SAPS and members of MPS have an obligation to report matters to IPID. But we have taken the note that when we amend the regulations, we have to make sure that we articulate that clearly in the regulations as well. And With regard to the issue that the chairperson has raised, making reference to a situation where the deceased's home is, let's say, KwaZulu-Natal, and the incident took place in Gauteng, I think the intention here was to make sure that
you are protected, and the two are okay, they are honorable members. So you can
If we take into account the fact that no investigator has to act on his or her own without consulting either the provincial head and or the executive director, in situations like those ones, the provincial head and the executive director would give your direction to say somebody else within one of our provincial offices can then be authorized to go and see the next of kin of that particular member. It does not necessarily mean that it has to be the person who has been designated to investigate that particular place in a particular locality. So it could be any other member of IPID as authorized by the executive director or the provincial head to do so.
Now, just on that one, I have learned as I've been participating in the processing of legislation that then people will say so and so will do this or will cause this to happen. You know, I've heard something like that, and immediately you do that, you are accommodating exactly what you are saying. Otherwise, for now, it says this person will do it. But if you're putting it upon that person, that if you are not able to do it, you must make it happen. It's your responsibility. For me, I think it makes sense. I've learned you will cause it to happen.
I fully agree, Professor. I think I've addressed some of the issues that have been left out.
I think the one issue that we missed, the question from Honorable Misha with regard to discharge of firearm, where does the person lie and the proof thereof? I think the Act provides that when there's a complaint of a discharge of firearm, then there's an obligation on the SAPS to report this matter for us to investigate. The regulation talks about the preliminary investigation. That preliminary investigation will involve ascertaining first whether it is in fact an official firearm that has been discharged, the nature of discharge, whether it caused harm to anyone or to property and so forth. And then once we've established those facts, then a full investigation will then proceed. So the burden of proof will therefore lie with us. We have to prove that in our investigation that there was in fact a discharge, and that discharge was a discharge of a firearm, and what were the consequences of that discharge. And then the Honorable Chairperson also asked a question with regard to the 7 days and whether the 7 days is now 14 days. The 7 days is with respect to the acknowledgement of the complaint itself, and then the giving of the feedback also is within 7 days. So it's not 14 days. It's 7 days all in all.
Chair, just a follow-up. I know that after tea, my concentration level may have dropped me. I had asked a question in relation to this 90 days. It's 90 days, what is the current? And I preface that with the Nyanga Police Station December death in the cell, or what six months down the line, I still have waiting for some information. And maybe because there's a T in between, my concentration level may have just dropped me. I didn't quite get the answer on that particular question. If I can be reminded, I could be reminded on it. And I'm sure the one of the capacities to come, if I could just be reminded. So on your question that we paused for a while in terms of the in consultation, I just want to say maybe it's probably a matter of formulation that requires some attention. That in reviewing process, you may have to revisit it, because if it's formulated the way it is, in consultation, and again that policy is not there, what then happens? So I think it's just a matter of formulation that you may have to consider. Thanks, Chair. I will wait for the other reply.
Thank you, Chairperson. Honourable members, right, we missed that question. What is the current turnaround time? The 90 days is current. It's IPIT 90 days. Before IPIT, in the ICD environment, it was within the financial year. So the completion of investigation was supposed to happen within that financial year.
The Nyanga matter is within the financial year.
Yes.
So it won't be 90 days. You would consider it within the financial year, which is this financial year.
No. What we're trying to explain, Honourable Member, is that in the ICD environment, when a matter is registered within that financial year, we must complete that investigation. That was the turnaround time at the time. In the IPIT environment, our new regulation now, we say within 90 days. So we're trying to basically up our game based on your advice. And that is why there's a proviso that in situation where it's not possible to complete that investigation within that 90-day period, then there should be a written reason why that investigation was not completed within that time frame.
Honourable Chairperson, there was a specific question, I think, by two or three members regarding Regulation 5. Do we have the sufficient capacity and tools to really enforce these regulations? I think also part of ensuring that there is really an upskilling of performance in the directorate, we need strict timelines, guidelines, and it must be also included in the performance agreements of the relevant managers and investigators. So we're saying with the 40 million that we got additionally from Treasury, we must be able to ensure that we fulfill our obligations. So we will be monitoring that as we go along. But it's quite important there must be proper accountability. I think Mr. Sissoko indicated the pre-IPIT period where there was not maybe the most effective guidelines and regulations, and that's really to tighten performance by investigators. So the current regulations on the table, we need compliance. So that's going to be our approach, and that's why it's also included in the performance agreements of the staff.
I'm not sure whether you have responded to my question on General Prison and Katamano Unit. I'm not sure whether you responded to that.
Chairperson, I think just after tea, I've indicated in terms of Kato Manor, at this stage the investigation is still ongoing as we speak here, and the DPP will quite soon make a decision in terms of that matter. That is in terms of Kato Manor.
Investigating General Prison.
He is one of the suspects in that matter, yes.
No, thank you very much. We will be interested to get feedback on the progress on that investigation. I don't know whether, I think there are no further questions. Executive Director, do you want to make some closing remarks?
Yeah, thank you very much, Chairperson. We appreciate the input of the members. As I've indicated, we will come back to the committee in writing in terms of those list of organizations and individuals who attended the process of getting the regulations on the table, and then of course the ED guidelines. We will then also bring to this committee, hopefully quite soon, also then to include those matters that was raised by the members. So we also do that.
No, thank you very much. No, thank you, Executive Director, and your delegation. I think we need to appreciate the fact that you've done some good job. Surely, when things have been done, you will always find something to improve, and that is what we have said. And we will indeed be monitoring the work of IPED. In ensuring that we have our sub-members discharging their responsibilities in the manner that is ethical and that is professional, but also giving the people of South Africa an opportunity to have a recourse on any matter that is pertaining to subs. This is a huge responsibility. I just wanted to remind you. Subs is a huge department, and police members are very powerful people, and the responsibility that you have therefore says you need people that have capacity, people that are prepared to do their work, who are not afraid, who cannot be bribed, who are ethical, who are professional in the manner in which they do their things. We hope that even now when I read this IPED Act, I think you now have the power, you have a legitimate mandate to do your work. I still believe that we wouldn't have given you more power than what we have given you in the IPED Act. So, you will not now say we don't have to bite. You have them. You have your teeth, you can bite, and you have got to bite. Like I indicated earlier on, the act is act. If people do not comply, the act must take its course, and that is all. Things must be done, irrespective. People are expected to comply and to conform. This is the act. It has got to be implemented full time, full force, and that is all. If at the beginning we show some signs that we can accommodate anything less than what the act stipulates, then we shall have had it wrong from the beginning. We will not be able to correct it. So as this portfolio committee, we are saying again, you have the act, it is in your hands. Make use of the act, and nothing more and nothing less. Make use of this act as IPED, so that we can have a country where people are accountable for their omissions, actions and commissions. I want to thank the members. In fact, it's already 12:45. I don't believe that we can look into minutes now. Honourable Annelies, I want to close.
I know you want to close. See, you've asked the subcommittee to give a report back on the detective day. If we can just do that in 3 minutes' time. The subcommittee on the detective, you asked us to give feedback today. So if we can just do that in 3 minutes' time, if you're not going to deal with the minutes today, then we can quickly do that.
So in fact, I think there are two things that we can deal with now. It's that report from that task team. One, but two, we can adopt our third session program as the committee. And I must say that even if we adopt it can always be changed because of whatever happens, but at least we must have a program that is adopted. So I think we can start there. You have copies of our program. It's in front of us. It says Tuesday, the 7th of August, that is that session. will be briefed by both IPED and the Secretariat on domestic violence reports. Remember, the other one is taking over, the other one is supposed to be handing over, but up until then, ICT was responsible, so they will have to brief us on those. I can see somebody wants to speak.
We should excuse the IPED crew while we do our own admin. They really have absolutely no interest in that, I'm quite sure.
I think you're correct. IPED is free to leave, really. And like I've said, thank you very much for the briefing. And then the following week on Tuesday, again, we're going to have a briefing by SAPS on progress made on building of police stations. And of course, they'll be briefing us on quarterly financial reports, that is the first quarter of the financial year. And I think the second quarter, no, first quarter. And then on the 21st of August, we'll be briefed by FFC on sub-budget allocation, because the budget is starting already, and also we'll be briefed by a secretariat on SAPS white paper. And then the following week, we'll be briefing on all specialized training we have set, but also in our stress plan, we identified three areas of focus. We said it's training, it's detectives, and we said buildings as well. Down there, we already have said on the 5th we're going to have a dialogue on detective services. It's down there, and this is what the task team will be reporting to us on. And then next Tuesday on the 11th, on the following Tuesday on the 11th, will be briefed by SAPS on all outstanding proclamations, international agreements referred to the committee, and will be adopting reports and minutes. And then after that, it will be a follow-up meeting with the private security industry CIRA. In fact, I was not in the meeting. I had to excuse myself. But I understand that the meeting agreed that CIRA will have to come back and brief the portfolio committee on a number of issues. So that is the meeting that we're going to have then. Then after that, it will be the constituency period. I think members we can do that. Honourable Kolapana.
Chair, could we just look at the 2 weeks of oversight given? I see in the program it says oversight starts on the 24th, the Tuesday. But I see we've quietly absorbed the Monday again, which is a constituency day. It makes it quite difficult because most of our big meetings are on the Mondays in the provinces. And also, of course, that weekend in between. We need to make sure that we get back, because I've also got two meetings on the Saturday and the Sunday in between that week. So it will have to be 1 week and then back to wherever we have to go and then the next week. We can't just absorb 16 days. So I think we need to discuss that quite carefully before bookings are made, those two weeks.
But you think, Honourable Kolapanet, you're saying we can't be out for 2 weeks in succession, is it?
Not at all. Absolutely, it's 2 weeks of committee oversight, but I'm saying the weekend in between. I've already got meetings booked for the Saturday and the Sunday, so we need to just make arrangements that we don't end up having to travel like we've done before. I'm just wary, because before you've made us travel on a Sunday morning to get somewhere, and that wipes out the Sunday and the Monday. So then there's massive scramble to rearrange meetings and things. So before we do any bookings, can we just discuss this? I know on the one Monday I've already got meetings because it's a constituency day. So we need to just talk about the logistics of those 2 weeks very carefully. Thank you.
Members? I fully understand what Honourable Kolapanet is saying, that Monday is a constituency day. One reason that probably makes us sometimes think that we could use Monday is that you then end up with 2 days. It could be Tuesday or 3 days, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. it was Friday, we will be rushing for flights and all, but we can't do that. But it reduces our numbers in provinces, and of course the police stations that we can visit. But we can actually start on Tuesday, if that's how members feel. We're stealing Mondays.
No, I wanted also to make a proposal, but we need to check actually.
I'm still talking. I will definitely allow you to speak. So that was the reason why, to say at least we have 4 days, and therefore 4 police stations, and then the last one we just do that job quick, and then we rest. But members can actually deal with it. Can deal with that. Honourable Lefet.
Yes, Chair. Yes, I say we need to check first. If Honourable Kola Bernard is busy on that particular day, she can be excused and join us later. But the rest we can continue because of the volume of work that we have to do. Thanks.
Chair, do we know which police stations we're going to visit in the Northern Cape? In which town? And do we take into account the distance between the police stations and the towns? Because if, for example, if you want to do Kimberley and you want to do Springbok, you have to travel 1,000 kilometers to get to Springbok, which will take you a whole day. Thank you.
We definitely are away. And what we normally do, Honourable State, if say for instance you are from Northern Cape, we get assistance from yourself. For instance, when we're in Limpopo, Mr. Swati assisted us to identify police stations and accommodation or hotels that could accommodate us that are nearby, in a way that it's possible to do the work without travelling long distances. And I think when we go to the Northern Cape, okay, we've not identified police stations, but we will definitely be assisted in identifying police stations, that it is possible for us to move from point A to point B and point B to point C and so on and so forth. So that one is not finalized. It's something that we'll be finalizing. Honorable Ramashakana, that your hand was up.
No, Chair, I think that I was looking at these dates. Didn't you say that this in principle approval that it can still change given what we, the work that still has to happen on it? If that's why I understand that you said so, that we can still be subject to amendment, I think we should accept it. I'm looking at on the Tuesday here, but now I was hearing the Monday that is also in the equation, but I'm looking at all the Tuesdays here as the SD days. So I think we should accept it with that in principle, and then of course we will then have to review in terms of the work that will be done, into practical work, whether we need to amend here and there, including the period. I mean, there's whole debate about the period. I think let's not engage with that now. Let's have a principle agreement on the program. And then, of course, we move on that basis.
No, thank you very much. And therefore, the report, that is what Honorable Ramatlakan is moving there to adopt the report, and seconded by Honorable Ndlovu. Thank you very much. And we're taking into cognizance issues raised by Honorable Kola Bernard, and I think if in an event we agree that we will start on Monday, it's possible to accommodate that the arrangements are made to join the committee. If we do that, I think it's possible, but also to check on the availability of members on the day and then take the final decision on the members.
So I should be able to make the one, but I can't make the second one.
Okay. No, thank you very much. We've adapted our program, Honorable Annelies.
The procedures now will be brief. The subcommittee has met twice already, and we want to report the following. We decided that we should look at calling the day a dialogue on detectives, and the theme to be the year of detectives developing the best. Objective of the dialogue, Minister declared 2012 the year of detectives. In support of this statement, the detective dialogue aims to highlight the role of detectives, identify the challenges faced by detectives, and assist in realizing the ideal of well-trained, fully resourced and professional detective service for the next decade. Topics for discussion. The idea is that we would have five topics of discussion, that we would have two specialists on each topic giving us a 10 to 15 minute speech, and then that those two specialists will form the panel. The people attending the dialogue, which include ourselves obviously, will then not only be asking questions but will have a dialogue in terms of issues around detectives. The first topic is the role and impact of detectives in the fight against crime, and this we thought must be done by somebody from the detective services. The importance of training for detectives, successes and lessons learned. Detective career development, the role and impact of detectives in solving crimes against vulnerable groups, focusing on women and children, modernization and resourcing of detectives and detective services. Various role players were identified to participate and attend the dialogue, and we welcome any more suggestions if members want to forward those suggestions to me of other people that we should involve as well. Please feel free to do so. Academic institutions, UCT, TUT, because of the fact that they do a police diploma, University of the Western Cape, the University of South Africa, and UKZN. Government structures, Ministry of Police, Department of Police, counterparts in the National Council of Provinces, provincial members of the Executive Council, chairpersons and groups of portfolio committees in the JCPS cluster, civilian secretariat of police, parliamentary research unit, and the parliamentary library services. Non-governmental organizations, ISS, Trawaranang, a legal advocacy center to end violence against women, Business Against Crime, South African Banking Risk Information Center, the SABRIC, Open Society Foundation. Logistics, we're looking at 100 people. We've booked it's been confirmed, the Old Assembly Chamber. We will start at 8:30 with registration. In preparation for the dialogue, we are suggesting Chairperson of the Research Unit will provide members of the Portfolio Committee with background information on detective services, including information on expenditure, personnel costs, and the like. We're looking at three coffee and tea breaks. The one would be when we start, and then two during the day, a finger lunch, and a dinner that will be sponsored, and we already have somebody that's willing from civil society is willing to sponsor the dinner for us in the end. Starting 8:30 for 9 o'clock, finishing at 6. We also would like to suggest, Jefferson, and also there we are in consultation and negotiations with people, that we publish a booklet following the completion of the detective dialogue, which will serve as an academic reference source. The booklet will be distributed to participants and attendees of the dialogue, as well as academic institutions. It will include the speeches, presentation by the participants, the fact sheet by the research team, and the summary of the discussions emanating from the presentations. And the rationale behind the booklet is to establish the Portfolio Committee of Police as an action-driven oversight body of Parliament. And then we have a draft program. I'm not going to go through all of that now, Chairperson. I've said that we've met twice already, and we are going to have a quick, very quick meeting now for 5 minutes or 10 minutes again. And then we have outstanding issues that we have is the issue on a secretariat for the day that will take minutes throughout the day, so that we can have the publication as soon as possible regarding that. And then, Chairperson, the issue of facilitator that I've taken up with you on whether we get a facilitator for the day or whether you want to chair the day, etc. That's the only outstanding issues that we do have at this stage. So that, in short, Chairperson, is the report back from the subcommittee.
Thank you. Honourable Annelies, members, this is the report. Can we interact with the report?
My first proposal, Chairperson, is that because we will be dealing with the matter within our department, the chairperson will be the right person to chair. That's the first proposal. The second proposal, which I agree with the presenter, is that the secretariat. Who will be the secretariat? I think we let's discuss this because we need a document immediately after that. But the first one, I'm very correct to say that because we're dealing with a matter which is within the department,
it has to be checked by the chairperson.
I think let's take that as a proposal, but see as to whether we can find a facilitator, because facilitating and chairing are two different things. You might be able to chair, but to facilitate it's something else. So a facilitator is somebody who will be there to facilitate. Yes, and I think we might probably get somebody who's able to do that. Sometimes you want to sit there and listen and make inputs and ask questions and so on. So, but let's not finalize the net. If, say, the task team brought names of facilitator, we can then look into that and then agree.
I agree with you, Chairperson, because I was just talking about Chairperson. I'm not talking about facilitation, because the 50 meetings start by Chairperson. And then anything that will happen will happen by facilitators who will be taking the matter forward. That's what I agree with.
Okay. No, thank you very much. I just wanted to check, you know, in my mind I have something like, what is happening internationally in detectives? What are the international best practices? Are we going to have an input that will give us something like that, the trends? Internationally, training, in terms of training, in terms of conviction rates, in terms of detective rates, and so on and so forth, in countries that are almost similar to us, but those that probably are first world countries and so on, where did they start, where are they moving, where are we in comparison to other countries of the world? Honorable Kola Bernard.
Yeah, Chair, I think, you know, there's a huge amount of research that's been done on this, so we might look to universities for a person to do a presentation, or the ISS, somebody, there'll be a specialist somewhere who's actually done a study on international best practice, and I absolutely agree, that's crucial to the entire day's proceedings.
Chairperson, yes, it actually does form, I said I'm not going through the program itself, but it actually does form part of the program as well, because we basically want all of these speakers, when they speak on the different topics, to do an international comparison. Even to those people that we've already been in contact with, we've asked them if they haven't done something like that, to start doing something like that as well. So that is the idea, that everything would be done in that sense. So that it's not only one presentation on international best practice, but that it goes throughout the whole presentation. What is international best practice in terms of the detective's role in dealing with crimes against women and children? What is the detective's international best practice in terms of modernizing the resources, etc.? So it will be a theme throughout the whole process, too.
I just wanted to go to objectives, because objectives will tell us as to what it is that we want to achieve at the end of the dialogue. What is it? So if I can actually see they are in the form of a paragraph, but, you know, I'm not a teacher by profession, but objectives should be formulated in the manner in which they are measurable. We were able to say this is what we have achieved, because it's going to assist us to highlight what we want to do and what it is that we need to do. So I'm just suggesting that they're not in the form of a paragraph, but they are tabulated as objective 1, objective 2, objective 3, because they're going to give us the direction. Members, anything else? Somebody's saying nothing. Thank you very much, Honorable Annelies, and thank you very much for this input. We think we're moving towards something, and that already there are people who will want to sponsor our dinner. We are appreciating that. We're meeting tomorrow. Yes, to adopt minutes.
Okay, will you excuse me for tomorrow? I've got another committee meeting.
Are we meeting tomorrow?
Chair, when Natasha, Natalie,
Nicolette, when she's supposed to, I'm here the whole day, I'm happy to meet all afternoon, do whatever, but I have to leave at 6 o'clock tomorrow morning. So that was my problem. But so I was hoping to meet with Angie today or this afternoon, and I never really heard anything further about our document. But certainly if you want to do minutes this afternoon, I've done all the minutes. I'm happy to just sit and go through and run through them if you wish.
And sir, if what the Honourable Ndlovu is just about to die is true, why don't we do it them today? Yeah, 1.5 hours after this afternoon, and then we can finish.
Listen, we unfortunately have other commitments this afternoon, so if we can't do it tomorrow, if that's agreement, then we must do it at a later stage. But the point is, Jefferson, that this raises the issue that we've raised before, is that we try and do minutes on a weekly basis so that we don't have to spend a day or 2 days adopting historic minutes. I think we've raised this in this committee before. Because we, from the side of the ANC, we can't this afternoon. It's impossible. We've got other commitments, other meetings that we need to attend.
No, I just to suggest that we were not rejecting tomorrow, but we were just thinking that this afternoon would be convenient. But if we had to do it tomorrow, then it's fine, because we understand the crisis you people are facing.
Oh, if not the case, we can take all these minutes and reports, go over them again. We have a meeting on Wednesday, and we go to the house. After the house, we meet, we adopt minutes. If that is okay, it will be when Parliament is on session, because I'm actually checking with members today, because I know there are no sessions. It's possible that people already have appointments with girlfriends and boyfriends and I mean
No,
I'm joking. See, after we've done this batch of minutes, perhaps we can work a system whereby as we start every single meeting, we approve the minutes of the time before. So we set aside, 20 minutes at the start of every meeting. We sit, we go through the minutes, and as long as people realize they must read them beforehand, and it's quick, but then we won't have this backlog again. Because, I mean, we really can't get to a stage where we have to set aside 5 hours worth of meetings to go through minutes. So if we can do it on a weekly basis before each meeting, I mean, that would make the most sense. I mean, that's how most meetings are actually conducted. First you approve the minutes of the previous meeting and then you move on. So just a thought.
No, we'll try that, but sometimes first before the minutes come to the portfolio committee, they go to the supposed to be a parliament committee for them to approve. Then they come to the chairperson for chairperson to read and then send them to the secretary to say no, yes, you can distribute. And sometimes they will be, the chairperson will not have time to read them. But also, let me mention, sometimes it will be minutes by the reports. So you have time frame for the reports, and the reports sometimes are, I think I'm just saying that. So it will be that. Sometimes it will be meeting after meeting. But like I'm saying, they also have their own, before they go to members, they've got to come to the secret chairperson. Sometimes the chairperson does not have time to read and say no, distribute them, and they're distributed. I'm just saying that. But we will try. One other issue is the fact that our meetings start at 9:30. That is one other issue. That if you want to, say for instance, like today, if say we wanted to accommodate minutes, we could do that. But then it means you've reduced time for the work that you have. It's possible, it could have been possible today with the work that was before the portfolio committee. But sometimes it's not possible. When it is the department, for instance, you want all the minutes and so on. But I want to close the meeting.
I hear what you said, but I agree with the Honourable Kula Bonnet, and we've decided this issue last year already, and I think we haven't started implementing it. That's part of the problem, so that we can see what the actual challenges are. Because really, in other committees, that is how we do it, in Parliament as well. In the private members committee that Comrade Molebatsi and myself serve on as well, we get the minutes every morning, the week after the previous meeting. So I think we need to start implementing it to see what the challenges are. If it means we sit from 1 o'clock to 20 past 1, once we finish, then let's do that as well. But really, I mean, we can also argue, Chairperson, that we could have 3 days of meeting with the department on other issues instead of dealing with minutes. So I think the point is let's start implementing it.
Thank you very much. Honourable members, the meeting is adjourned.